When you stand back and examine your life, you see that the moments when you have been fully at home, like I notice that there was a stage where I was always time-binding, where when I was here with you, I was anticipating the fact that Saturday I'll be at the temple, Sunday I'll be flying to California, Monday I'll be with Creating Our Future, Wednesday I'll be with the teachers, then I'll be in Europe. And I mean, it was all real at this moment. And I constantly had the sequencing of where I came from and where I was going in my mind. So I was always planning and anticipating, and it kept, what's changed now is that much more of the time, I'm a long way away from being cooked, but much more of the time when I am here, this is it, I am here. And when I'm not here, I'm not here. And it's interesting how when you give another human being, your family or your business, the fullness of your being at any moment, a little is enough. While when you give them half of it, because you're time binding with your mind, there's never enough. And you begin to hear the secret that being fully in the present moment is the greatest gift you can give to each situation. That when I'm walking up, going to the bathroom, and I meet somebody in the path, and they say, have you got a minute? Now, unless I've got diarrhea, I probably have a minute. And I say, yeah. And then I turn to them, and at that moment, I'm not somebody going to the bathroom listening to their question. I'm just right here. And that takes me less time to deal with that thing fully so that I hear them fully and they hear me hearing them and we do the communication than if I keep holding on to, yeah, sure, but I'm always thinking about going to the bathroom while I'm listening to the question. And it's taken me a while to learn how to, that if I'm going to offer the gift of my being, it means offering the fullness of the moment in. And the feeling that I'm not doing enough at home when I'm at work ending up you don't do enough at work and you don't do enough at home. While if you did your work fully when you're at work and your home fully when you're at home, and that's by standing back enough in that awareness to see the pieces of your life and see those little books that have my week in it, my week planners, I guess they're called, where you stand back and you see what's in your life. I see that I'm working on a book. I see that I have some AIDS patients. I see that I have, I've got Seva. I see that I've got my relationships. I see that I've got the teenage creating our future. I see that I've got the retreats. I see that I've got to rest. I see the sort of pattern of my life. And I look and I realize, well, I've overextended. I've got too many things. So I'll have to start to work towards cutting back till I've got a number that I can handle. Then I see that each one will take so much time. And I get a kind of I stand back and I allow those moments when I sort of see the web and the pattern of it all. Like I'll make a list of all the things I'm involved in life. Just all the different things. And then I'll look and I'll say, do they create a life, first of all, that is fulfilling my unique opportunities in the universe? Am I understanding each of them as part of my spiritual path? Because that's what my business is about. Is each one appropriate? Do I want to phase it out or do I want to keep it? Should it take a bigger part of my life? I stand back and I get a feeling of the design of my life. And once I'm at peace with the design of my life, then when I'm at each thing, the other part of me that's already stood back and seen the design of it is at peace. And then I can fully be in the thing I'm in. Right? It's when it's undigested and you don't stand back and get that perspective about it, that you are constantly feeling you're not doing this when you're doing that. Do you hear what I'm trying to say? So I'm just giving you a little plan of action. One is cultivating the spacious awareness that sees the whole thing before you. And the other is the practice of when I'm here, if I do this when I'm here, this is the best gift I can do to this. The best gift you can do to everything that's going to come up in your life in the future is to do what you're doing at this moment fully. Because that's the training, to be fully present in the moment, which is the best gift you give each situation. So the best gift you can give to your family when you're at work is to be at work. Am I dealing with a question? Okay, next one.
If you could elaborate on how we can integrate a task or goal orientation with a receptive, intuitive approach to life.
In the third patriarch, the first line, the great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. As I study that, it doesn't mean you don't have preferences. It means you are not clinging to your preferences. But you make all your actions are based on preferences at one level or another, but you are not identified with that level. So the level at which there is task, it's the same issue of impeccability. The level at which you function as a task-oriented being is different from the level of the intuitive heart-mind or the sin-sin. And they start to interplay, and they have to do with that answer I gave the other day about consistency and truth. Because the intuitive wisdom is embracing of all the phenomena, the gestalt of what is historically and existentially present at the moment. And it takes all of it in and gives you the most appropriate response. Now, a task orientation, which comes really out of the analytic mind, then plans a strategy. And you start to act out that strategy. And often what happens is, in order to act out a strategy, you think you have to close down your intuitive wisdom. But if you keep them open, the only problem with keeping it open at the same time as you're carrying out the task is that it might make you inconsistent. That is, you might start the task, and then after some time, the intuitive gestalt shows you that it is no longer the optimum behavior. And the interesting question for many of us is how you've designed your life to allow for the minimum amount of inertia between the time that you realize you're intuitively off the wall and you're willing to stop the behavior. And the predicament is most of us live in a world of lock-in where everybody expects you to be consistent, carry out tasks, to complete them and all. So you find yourself living with an awful lot of inertia. Now, how you deal with that, that is part of the existential situation that the intuitive wisdom understands. So the art form is, to the extent that you can, you design your life in a way that allows for maximum flexibility, that you can change in midstream as you're able to do. And you, to the extent that you can, you surround yourself with people that can handle that. And you surround yourself with life work that allows for that. Now, to the extent that you have made commitments and contracts and entered into expectations with other people, then for you to be inconsistent does violence to those things, which in itself creates new karma that you then have to deal with. And that's all part of the intuitive wisdom. So that there is a point where, even though you see that where you're going is no longer, it's sort of the result of an old calcified idea that you had a while back, that you're living out now, and you're caught in your old mind, the inertia of the system demands that you keep going in it for a while to complete it honorably. And then that becomes your spiritual sadhana at that point, your practice, to be able to stay in it. Like I came out of the 60s. I didn't come out of it. I was already old in the 60s, but I was an uncle of the 60s. And in the 60s, we all had the feeling of, you know, be here now, we called it, and live in the moment and change as fast as you want to change and run it up the flagpole, see who salutes it, you know, let's just do what means the right thing at this moment. And the ideas like sustainability or persistence or patience or continuity were the establishment words. They weren't the words of the New Age. The New Age were, you're with a person as long as it feels good, and if it doesn't, screw it, you know. And so it changed a lot of social patterns. And when I became involved in Seva, I was still that person, and it was very exciting to start a program. And then after 5 years, when it turned out that we had taken on to help eradicate blindness in Nepal, and there was still a lot of blindness in Nepal, and we were 5 years down the path, and I thought, my God, I'm sucked into this game. I can't get out. I kept saying to everybody, I think I'll quit. I think I've had enough. And then I had to face the fact that I had, that this was an opportunity for me to learn other qualities of life. That freedom wasn't external freedom. Freedom was internal freedom. And that I was confusing my freedom to shift games with freedom. When I was trapped with a model about what rush I needed from the life that made me want to shift all the time. And that actually I've learned from a lot of people that live in very strict form and are free within form, not free because they push away form. And I have been learning how to be free in form rather than being free from form, and realize that freedom is the freedom to be in form without railing against it, and to be able to move in and out of planes so that I can have be part of Seva as the continuity of a project that supports Dr. V and supports Nepal and supports Guatemala, and do it every year and raise the money and do the thing as best I can, and at the same moment be free within it. And that if I rushed off, because I spent years, hey, I'd rather be in Bali. So I'd go to Bali. And then I'd be just as neurotic in Bali as I was in Boston. And I think, well, what I really need is to be in southern Italy. So I go to southern Italy. Well, what I need is really a love affair in, you know, and I go do that. And I go do that. And what I really need is, an, you know, and I keep, I think I need to be accepted by, and I do that. And I kept running from here to here until I saw, I remember I was in Japan in a zendo, and we used to read a Hakuin's prayer every morning and aloud, like we do the metta meditation. And one of the lines is, your coming and going is nowhere but where you are. And there I was in Japan on my way from India back to the States. Your coming and going is nowhere but where you are. And I started to sense that there's a place in me where there's no coming and going. I mean, I get on the plane and the plane flies its heart out, and then I end up here and I'm still here. Where did I go? And that was the meaning of be here now. Where could you go anyway? And once I started to realize that, going everywhere and collecting more experiences started to lose its power over me. I mean, I'm not as, there's a little cynical edge at times when I don't have it purely in mind, because each thing is fresh and new. Somebody will say, hey, come and look at the sunset. And I feel like saying, I've seen a sunset, you know, but you don't do that because it's a new sunset. But then you begin to see that you don't have to keep collecting experiences, that it's all inside you. It's enough. You can be with enough. And working out of enoughness instead of need for more is a great art form, great art form. Questions? I keep running around.
It's like every airport has a pretty picture of another city.
Yeah, every airport has a pretty picture of another city. Isn't that great? Yeah, yeah. It's all a travel agent. And it's interesting because they say, you know, like, I can't stand New York. It brings me down. Big cities. But what brings you down are your desires that are latent seeds that get fanned by those billboards and posters and come-ons and want this and desire that and all that. Once you have consumed that stuff in you and you're peaceful, then you can be in cities, and it's just like you're in a cave in the Himalayas. What difference does it make? If you want something, it all turns into discrimination of I prefer this to that. Once you go beyond that, you don't have to prefer anything. You take what you're given.
Are there any methods to deepen one's appreciation of the ordinary, to not take it all for granted, but somehow make sacred our ordinary experience?
Mm, that's nice.
in a way, just continually asking that question is almost enough, because it allows you to look freshly at what is. The problem is that we get so caught in the habits of mind, we can't look freshly again. And as you extricate yourself from those patterns of thought, you look at everything freshly, and it's all as if it's just, look, I am making all things new. It's just all emerging, and it's all very precious and very beautiful and very fresh and very new. I think that we have also not invested in rituals that allow us to affirm the beauty of what is natural to us all the time. Rituals around stages of life, rituals around changes in nature like solstices, and rituals around fertility, rituals around harvest, rituals around eating, rituals around resting, rituals around planets, rituals around gathering together. We don't invest in making it sacred. We keep profaning it into our own greed of, I want that, I desire that. I think when a group comes together and gets very quiet inside, they start to be interested in creating rituals. The predicament with rituals is, what is a technique for awakening you to the freshness one moment, a moment later is an institution that puts you to sleep and that's lost its juice. As Gurdjieff said, an alarm clock that wakes you one moment, you can sleep right through later on. And most of the rituals that we find abhorrent were rituals that at one time were rituals that awakened people. And so you have to sort of keep recreating them over and over again is really what's required. It involves slowing down. I mean, when you read, like I remember reading books by Anne Morrow Lindbergh, in which there's just such an appreciation in so many of those books of poets that just appreciate the fullness of the moment. And that's part of why we use poetry and art. Because it is somebody reminding us of the appreciation of the simplest thing as a bowl of fruit or light coming through a window pane or something like that. I mean, what Matisse or Gauguin can do to remind us is quite incredible. I have a feeling that the spiritual path people tend to get caught in treating as trivial the earth plane until they get more evolved, when they see that in the earth plane is the manifestation of God and the mother as well, that it's the mother manifest. And then they begin to reverence it and just treat it with reverence. I mean, when you're around American Indians who are steeped in their own tradition, they walk on the earth with reverence. You can feel that, the way they walk on the earth. And when they do that, it reminds me about what's happening. And it's such a gift to be reminded that way. So we remind each other. We help each other do that. We move through life so much in our minds, in our thoughts, that we lose the process, because we're so busy focused on the product. I mean, the driving to Breitenbusch is as much as the getting to Breitenbusch. The walking back to your cabin is as much as getting to the cabin. There's a whole quality of learning how to stop into the moment. I have a little exercise I often do of just stopping to appreciate just what's happening at this moment. I'm driving along and I try all the different levels of appreciation at this moment. Well, here I am, 58 years old, driving my car here, and I feel a certain way, and this is what's happening. Oh, that's interesting. And then I move it out a level, and then down a level, and I keep moving levels of describing what's going on. And the thing gets so thick. I mean, the moment gets so thick because each plane is another richness. It's like baklava, you know. It's all those planes of, you know, and everyone has nuts in it. Questions? That's it? I've just come to see that a beautiful practice is whenever you notice yourself judging in the sense of identifying with the judgment, to just flip it into appreciation. To just go from judging into appreciation. And I've trained myself now so that now a good percentage of the time, certainly not all of it, I get lost a lot, but still a good percentage, significantly more than used to be, the judging, I can feel the heaviness of the place that judging comes from. I feel the cottonness of it. And the minute I feel that, instead of, oh, shit, I'm judging, I immediately turn around and take that same thing and appreciate it. So that those of you that had problems with parents, I mean, one of the things about appreciating is appreciating exactly what they were caught in and how they ended up being what they were. Because when you look at somebody and you say, you did that to me. When you stand back a moment, they didn't do it to you. They did it because that's who they are. And there's a certain point where the whole responsibility shifts in drama and where you realize that when you look at a soul coming into life with a curriculum that involves other people doing things to it, you realize that the soul is using the other person to do it to itself. Now, this is a very tricky issue because at the misunderstood level, it's you're responsible for your cancer, which people hear as personality, and unfortunately, it really wipes them out. It's a very harsh thing. From a soul's point of view, the soul is creating the curriculum. And so in that sense, when your parent has abused you, they were just doing what they were doing because they were out of control because of their desire systems, which are the results of their parents and on, 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 and on. And you, from a soul's point of view, were using them to do that to you because that's what you needed in your curriculum. Now, that's a heavy-duty spiritual interpretation that sounds like gross rationalization from somebody that doesn't understand those other dimensions. And it doesn't mean it's a justification for not helping anybody or stopping it. But at the same moment, it is a way of looking at the people that have been involved in your life so that you can finally get free of the judging of your parents and the judging of the people around you. As they didn't love me, they hurt me, he left me, all of those things, that stuff. Because you begin to appreciate that, especially in relationships which are things you enter into as a conscious being, or more or less as an unconscious being, you begin to see the way in which, at a deeper level, you already knew the handwriting on the wall of how it was all going to come out. Somebody said, I went in and then he left me, and I was so shocked. Had you listened carefully, the seeds of all of it were in there, and that's the same way that gurus understand the future. Because they understand all the seeds, that it's all lawful, so there's no surprises. The law was already there. It's all written in each human being. And then they get in, they constantly surprised because they were caught in their desire system, which clouded their minds so they couldn't hear the truth of the situation. You've all seen it in other friends where you see somebody getting out of a relationship where it was very destructive, and then you watch them get into another one that's going to be equally destructive, and they're in the, oh, it's so beautiful, and this will be altogether different, and you know it's going to, and when you're doing the same thing, all the time. We are constantly using the universe around it to do it to us. And this isn't to be blamed to the personality, because that's just the thing itself. From the soul's point of view, you get to appreciate that each person's just living out their drama. And then they're interacting, and those interactions are the grist for each other's mill of awakening. From a soul point of view, you develop appreciation. From a personality point of view, you've developed judgment. You feel had at the personality level. You feel appreciative from the soul level. So I would say that every time you judge and get caught in it, that's a good thing to remind you. You just lost the flick to the up level of consciousness. And use it to flick back up. Use it to flick out again into, yeah. When, especially when you're judging yourself. Like, I was fatigued. Sorry, I was fatigued. I was tired. I wasn't very conscious. And I went away feeling badly that I had let you down. Okay. Now, there's judgment. I started walking back the path. I felt, boy, am I caught in my judging mind about myself. And then I slowly just saw this guy walking down the path, judging himself. How poignant he is. You know, he's just that old guy doing that thing again. Ah, there he is. And I began to appreciate him. By the time I got back to my cabin, I was ready to go to sleep. Yeah. Okay. Questions?
Hi, Ramdas. This is basically one question, but it's phrased two ways, and you can kind of pick which you like best. And it's, how do we strike a healthy balance between mindfulness practice that we do daily and play? And its second form is, how do we practice awareness and at the same time, that witness space of awareness, and at the same time develop and enjoy spontaneity?
If you notice the level of evolution of the different students of meditation, you will notice that there are certain stages in their development where play is gone and where spontaneity is gone. Because they're still learning the technique, and they are so careful to be very aware of everything, because they're using it as in a formal way to take them in deeper. Then what happens is, when the practice starts to work, you see people becoming mindful. They are mindful in a very light way. And it's like, I have a friend, Joseph Goldstein, and some of you, he to me is, I think, the highest meditation teacher in the United States at the moment, in terms of a Westerner. And Joseph is extraordinary, and he is one of the lightest people I know. He's just like a feather. He's just light, and we play all the time together. And yet, all the play, there is very clear mindfulness in it. It is not like you have to lose your mindfulness into play. In fact, play can become a new level of delight when you are playing and you're also aware you're playing. And you're aware together that you're playing. I mean, it's just levels upon levels upon levels. And I'm just enjoying the increased richness of the play with more conscious beings. It gets, because it's like like humor, for example. I've just started to get to know, as a friend, Robin Williams. And I feel in him a quality of compassion that colors his humor. And he can be very sharp, but the sharpness doesn't hurt in the way. It is a healing kind of humor. And it's a humor that is a mindful kind of humor. It's coming from another kind of space of awareness. And I've been very interested in the difference between the kind of Las Vegas humor which wounds, and the kind of compassionate humor like a Will Rogers or people like that, that keeps bringing people into a lighter, clearer space. So I'm learning that there is play and fun that isn't divisive, that is unifying. And but there are stages in spiritual practice where people get really, quote, serious about it, And that is going to be honored because it's necessary for that to happen before you can get the techniques learned well enough to have them pay off so you can get light again. You will notice in every tradition, you will see students go through the fanaticism stage. They've got the only way, and everybody else is an asshole who's not doing it, and they feel terribly sorry for them. And you've just got to be very compassionate for them. I mean, I face that in every religious tradition I've met thus far. And then when you meet a real mensch in any of the traditions, you know, a real evolved one, they know that every people get there by all kinds of paths. And then they're much lighter about their way. I think that most people have to, yes. I think you start out kind of dilettante like I am, and then you kind of finally get pulled into a method, and when you get into the method, you really got to play it. You can't screw around with it. You got to really do it. And it takes really a commitment. And during that time, you can't really be spacious and about all kinds of methods. You got to just do your method. And in order to bring the juice to doing it, you really have to sort of see it as the way to do it, because it can't be just one way. It's got to be the way. And then as it the way pays off, then you get like Ramakrishna, who could make each way the way. Right? But that's a stage. More questions?
On our first night here together, you talked about that when being in the, when in the presence of someone you love, or in the presence of the beloved, there is no words. There is just beingness. And I would like to know more about the language of beingness.
Well, in a way, that line doesn't work, the language of beingness, because language itself is the finger pointing at the moon, and the moon is the beingness. And so every time you're using language, you're always away, again, one thought away from the state of being. The minute you think about it, it's not the same thing. It's slight separation. Beingness, we can talk about conditions for beingness. Beingness, where boundaries break down. When you say, I am everywhere, or everywhere I am, or I am nobody, therefore I am everything. Beingness starts with listening into the universe, and then the listener disappears into the listening, and there is just the quality of the air in the room, and the quality of the movements of the bodies, and the quality of the states of emotional being in everybody here, and the qualities of quietness and reaching to understand. And as we all keep opening and opening in these silences, we start to be all of this all at once. We are the heaviness of the air. We're the changing weather. We are at the end of the retreat. We are the softness and sweetness we've tasted with one another. We are the risks we've each taken. You can feel how we keep expanding into the qualities of the fullness of the moment. And, as long as you are the listener, you're still separate. So the listening is what starts the process. And then in a way you listen, you turn your skin inside out, you listen yourself into it until there is just what is. It just is what is. And at that moment, the term relationship disappears because you are no longer separate from that which you love. The quality of awareness permeates all of it, and the identity with that awareness makes all of us share the same exact space.
So we know each other from inside here rather than from knowing you as an object. It's a quality where, like, when I sit with Maharaji, I can sit with the pictures and remember the form, and then I can sit with the feeling of his presence in the room, like you're in a dark room and you know somebody's in there, but you can't see them. And then if I keep getting quieter and quieter, which now and then happens, it's as if there's a merging, not that he became me or I became him, but that we became it. That the identity of the forms dissolved. It's like the stuff, all of this stuff keeps dissolving into awareness. It keeps dissolving into this substance. When you study physics, and you get into the more and more, into quantum mechanics and into quarks and so on, if you keep getting down and down and down, you get to a stuff that is common to everything in the universe. And it's only the patterns of that stuff that determine form. And that stuff is moving, it's in everything, so that the stuff that's in the star is then in your body, is in the air, is in the, and it's all one stuff, and it's all moving all the time. And it's just the patterning of that for a moment. And the patterning keeps changing, that keeps giving something a solid look. And in a way, that's the closest physical analogy, and that's still right on the edge of theoretical, not actually measurable, unseeable. You don't see that. You theoretically infer it. The quality of that is the same thing as awareness. And in that sense, I used to have a camera for a while. It was stolen, but it was a movie camera. It was a Bolex, I think. And what you could do was you could take a movie of a tree, and then you could wind the film back, and then take another movie, like of somebody walking towards you. And then it would look like the person just walked out of the tree. And you could play with these double images just by rewinding the film and shooting it again. And I did a whole movie. I had a wonderful time with this movie because it was the closest to the way in which I experience the way in which we come into being, where all of the finite boundaries that our mind keeps focusing on kept dissolving until everything was all interrelated with everything else and coming in and out of it. And as long as you're focusing on your seeing mind, seeing and thinking, everything keeps having discriminative preciseness. You are you and I am me. But it's just like when we close our eyes and just experience the space. But then we have our ears, and I just heard that cough, and that cough was there, not here. I remember working with a woman who was dying, and she said to me, Ram Dass, she said, it's all too much. It's too much. She says, the light's too much, the sound's too much. And I said, well, Jean, what do you say? Let's do an exercise. Let's expand outward together. And everything you hear or feel, experience it as inside of yourself, not outside. And we heard the children playing outside, and I said, hear the children? And she nodded, and I said, they're inside us. Hear the clock ticking. And I saw her fingers working with the counterpane. I said, do you feel the quilt? Feel that feeling inside of us. They just kept expanding outward, expanding outward. It's a form of meditative yoga. And pretty soon everything, you've just expanded your boundaries. The term too much is because you have a finite container and then you're pushing against everything. When you expand outward to incorporate everything, you just keep expanding, and then it's all just being, and there's no boundary any longer. And she kept expanding outward, and you could see all the muscles of her face releasing and relaxing.
just this softening into being. And then she sat up and we hugged and kissed. And then a few hours later she died.